Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks is also brought to you by LPLI, a confidential online 360-degree leadership assessment inventory. LPLI is designed to help those working in the church identify individual strengths and weaknesses so they may improve their ministry effectiveness. LPLI is available in pastor and staff versions. Learn more at lpli.org. Are virtual meetings and work-from-home staff part of the new normal in your church? In this episode, John Wimberly discusses best practices for working with staff and volunteers in a hybrid era.
I'm Ann Michael. I'm one of the editors of Leading Ideas e-newsletter, and I'm your host for this episode of Leading Ideas Talks podcast. I'm talking today with John Wimberly, who for many years was the pastor of Western Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., and now he consults and advises congregations primarily on issues related to management and staffing and volunteers and teams, first through the Alban Institute and now with the Congregational Consulting Group. He's the author of several books, and his most recent book is Managing Congregations in the Virtual Age, and that's the subject for our conversation today. So welcome to you, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So your book begins with the observation that the transition to the digital world that most congregations made in response to the pandemic was relatively easy compared to the issues of managing staff and volunteers in the virtual sphere, which has received considerably less attention. And so I wondered if you could explain why you believe that to be the case.
Sure. Well, I mean, any pastor listening to this is going to object to the idea that that transition was easy.
But, yeah.
But nonetheless, compared to managing people, it was easy. And the reason it was easier, and I've got to hand it to, I mean, clergy and congregations across the country, small to large, made this transition so quickly. It's really stunning how quickly they did it and how well they did, the quality of it. But that was technology. And so you bought things, you learned things, and you learned how to apply the technology. And you had, you know, as a preacher, you had to learn some tricks about communicating with a camera versus communicating with a live audience, those kinds of things. But it's nothing like managing people. Managing people is always going to be the most difficult thing and the most fun thing, frankly, that we do as clergy. And so that's why I think one, I would describe one as significantly easier than the other. The other thing is that nobody, well, this isn't totally true anymore, but very few seminaries really teach us much about managing people while we're in seminary. I mean, Wesley, Columbia, a few others have done a really good job of educating clergy once they're out in the field. Maybe you have to be in the field doing it before you can learn it. I don't think so, but at least you're doing it. A lot of seminaries never do. And so managing people is something you either learn to do or fail to do on your own, pretty much. My first book was called The Business of the Church. I spent a lot of time in that about managing people, too, because it's so important. Because your whole ministry can fall apart if you don't manage staff correctly. I work with congregations as a consultant all the time where typically the senior minister has made some kind of mistakes in managing people, and it's created all kinds of tension within the life of the congregation. So, you know, the way I frame this whole thing of managing people in a virtual setting is that most clergy weren't very good at managing someone who was down the hall in their office. So what happens when they're across town or maybe in another state if they chose to go someplace else, which
right.
Some people do.
So
yeah. it just amps it up.
Right. So can you name some of the issues that should be top of mind for churches in this era when many of their staff and volunteers may be opting to connect remotely? What do people need to be thinking about?
The number one thing has to do with output, productivity. So what do we expect from people? And mm-hmm. that should have been the issue when the person was down the hall, as right. well as when the person's across the town. You can't manage people because, you know, when they were sitting down the hall, they could have just been sitting in their, going on Facebook in their computer in their office. So it's not like the first time they had the opportunity to just use the computer for less than work-oriented reasons was when they moved to work from home. They can do that in the office too. So so how do you do that? You create very clear productivity outcomes. This is what we want you to do. You don't tell them how to do it. You hire people who've got an entrepreneurial, self-starting approach to reality and to work, and then you let them do it. But you have to be clear about what it is you want. And then the hardest thing for the church in general to do is you hold people accountable to whatever that output standard is. So if they said that they were going to do X, but they did Y, then there has to be a conversation, a not so easy conversation, about what happened to X. That's what we asked you to do, and you ended up doing Y. So the accountability, the church and accountability are just, we have such a bad relationship.
Yeah, so I think that's a point that comes through loud and clear in your book, that a lot of people as staff have moved to remote work are really worried about, you know, are they really working and how can you hold your staff accountable? And you make the, I think, very important point that how churches hold staff accountable has always been an issue in congregations, you know, and not just whether they're on Facebook on their computers, but whether their work is really accomplishing what churches hope and expect that it should. And so what are some of the ways that congregations can hold their staff accountable, both in-person and virtual spaces?
So, I mean, the first thing is defining the output. So you have to say, this is what we want you to do, and this is the quality of work that we expect. And then there has to be some kind of time frame. So say in 3 months or 6 months or a year, and it'll kind of depend on the task as to the time frame. Some things take a year to get done. Sometimes things take a week. But you'll say, and we're going to evaluate this. I'm not a big believer. In fact, I don't believe at all in annual performance reviews. And there's a lot of research to back my statement up on that, which I refer to in the book. But there has to be an ongoing performance review. So I'll go into a church and I'll be doing a staff design, and the senior pastor will say, well, we've got one person who's really not very effective, and she's a wonderful person, and the congregation loves her, but, and then I'll go, so how long has this person been working here? 13 years. So yeah. you've had somebody on your staff not functioning at a kind of a respectable level for 13 years. I mean, how do you do that? How do we run an organization by tolerating people? And I don't think we're doing any favors to the person who's been there for 13 years under functioning.
I'm very fond of the book by your colleagues, Gil Rendell and Susan Beaumont, on staffing. And I mean, they make the point loud and clear that, you know, churches so often bring the values of grace and compassion, they hold those foremost, and not understanding that in an employee-employer situation that there's different standards for what the nature of the relationship needs to be. I want to get back to this issue of the reality of managing in a virtual time, which is the title and main focus of your book. And so, what are some other issues that need to be top of mind beyond this issue of how staff are held accountable? But what other issues do people need to be thinking about as we're in this new way of engaging?
Right. So I wrote the book during the pandemic, and I interviewed a lot of clergy, both rabbis and Christian clergy, and they said that the single most difficult thing for them was the lack of what I would call hallway conversations. Mm-hmm. And one rabbi, and I think I relate this in the book, talked about the fact that, you know, they were getting irritated with each other, they being their staff, because certain things weren't happening and they couldn't quite figure out why. And they realized that they had been coordinating a lot of their work as they walked by each other in hallways,
right,
or they met in the office, or they saw each other in the parking lot and that kind of stuff. So one of the issues about being virtual is that there has to be some very strong intentionality about communicating, so that on a daily basis, probably, those kinds of tasks don't get lost. So, you know, he told me one story about where there was no holler, and he couldn't figure out why there wasn't any holler, because there always been holler. Well, turned out the associate rabbi always brought the holler, you know, but he never told her that because he thought it'd be insulting. So, to remind her of that. So there's going to have to be some stuff which at the beginning will feel kind of awkward, but because I'm convinced that a lot of staff stuff is going to become more virtual rather than less virtual. I mean, it's the same thing with meetings. I mean, people have figured out, I don't have to drive for 20 minutes to the church, go to a 1-hour meeting, and then drive 20 minutes home. I just don't see that happening ever again. I mean, they'll get together for big meetings like council meetings, things like church governing board meetings, things like that. But a lot of these meetings where people drove to the church to have the meeting, they're gone, and they're going to be virtual. So kind of managing all of that stuff and building a communications system in which everybody can stay connected to each other is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, I know. I think that's not just in terms of staff and leadership. I think that's going on a grand scale in the church that I attend, church-wide. I mean, I feel like, people who always were in the know about everything don't know what's going on because for the very reason that you described, and it's created a real communication challenge. There are all these small groups that are together virtually, but the connector points, sort of the informal communication that kept everything together has just kind of is missing, and it's weird.
It's weird for the staff too, because the staff feel disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of anxiety in the air right now about what's going to happen in September is just like crazy amounts of anxiety, because people are just we've lost a sense of what it's like to be connected that way again.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about digital meetings, let me ask whether this is for clergy who lead staff or volunteer leaders who lead different ministry teams. What do they need to be attending to differently in these digital meeting spaces? How is the function of managing a group different?
Right. So my consulting business just went crazy during the pandemic. And so I was constantly attending to this particular issue. And there, I did a lot of reading from the business world about how, you know, things to do and things not to do in virtual meetings. One of them is in a lot of companies, you cannot go off screen. And in church meetings, routinely, people will go off screen. And you say, well, what's the big deal with that? It's a privacy issue. Well, the big deal is most of us sit there and go, I wonder what they're doing. I wonder if they're even there. You know, are they even attending the meeting behind the thing that's got their name on it there in the Zoom box? So that, you know, setting some rules about what you can and cannot do is extremely important. As the person running the meeting, the extroverts always have the upper hand in terms of jumping into stuff in any kind of meeting. So you have to pay extra attention to making sure that everybody is asked, do you have anything further that you'd like to add, to somebody who has said absolutely nothing? even in groups that are as small as 6 to 9 people, I'll ask a question and then say, let's use the breakout room feature and go into groups of 3 and then come back and we'll have a discussion about what we talked about in those small groups. Because that gives the introverts an opportunity to speak in an environment in which they're comfortable. So, all things considered, I think that the virtual meeting has a lot of strengths. I make the point in the book about diversity. So as an example, a lot of seniors don't like to drive at night. So they can zoom in on a meeting and they don't have to drive at night. A lot of young parents don't want to have to pay for or set up childcare in order to leave home and go to the church or the synagogue for a meeting. And using virtual meetings, they don't have to. Same thing could be said with people with various kinds of disabilities. People who are working can just step away from work and get their phone and come in that way. So the opportunity to include people who otherwise might not participate is exponentially larger.
Have people in my church who have moved away, some living overseas, who now all of a sudden have reconnected with the church because they have the opportunity to do so. I mean, that's been one of the blessings. I did want to ask about, this has brought so many challenges, but it's also brought a lot of opportunities as well. Are there other ways in which you see this as advantageous or positive for churches to be moving in this direction?
Absolutely. So along those lines, where you were just talking, there's two churches I work with regularly who have seasonal, they're located in vacation spots. So they have large seasonal attendees. Those people are now attending year round because they can. They're in Florida in the winter, but now during the summer they're attending worship virtually. So it's helping that way. The other thing is that I think and why churches should not let up off the gas here on this live streaming stuff. If anything, they should be investing it to improve the quality of their live streaming. Is that I've been contending for a long time that people church shop virtually first. And what I meant by that previously was they would go to websites of a church, they'd move into a town, and they'd go to the websites of the churches that they might be interested in, and they would read sermons, or they would listen to sermons, or they would view sermons based on the technology that congregation was using. And that was like pre-shopping. And then they would narrow it down to a list and go, these are the churches we want to go to live. Well, live streaming just takes that up a notch. And I'm actually seeing this or hearing about it. A congregation that I work with in Fort Collins, the pastor just told me this week that they had 5 or 10, I can't remember, somewhere in that range of people come to church who started attending worship while during the pandemic, live streaming. And they're now attending now that they've gone back to face-to-face worship. And they're going to join the church. So there are some real evangelism opportunities here in terms of making it easy for people to hear and see what you're about, what's your understanding of the gospel if you're a Christian person.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although I do hear people asking whether, I think people used to see, they go to your website first to check you out, and then that would eventually lead them to visit you in person. I think a lot of people are wondering if people will ever get to that point of coming in person, whether those new people that you connect with are just going to remain comfortable in that digital space and never be somebody who actually ever crosses your threshold. It's hard to know.
My guess is it's going to be a both and.
Yeah.
51% of the U.S. population are Gen Zers or millennials. Half the population are millennials and Gen Zers. And that's a fact most churches don't know and aren't paying any attention to whatsoever.
Yeah, because they don't see them.
They say we want younger people, but they really don't understand the urgency of this thing. But at any rate, if you look at those two generations and the way they act, they have both virtual communities, friendships, and they have face-to-face ones. My granddaughter is 22, is an example of that. So she's friends with people in New York, even though she lives 2 hours north of New York, and she feels as close to them as the people that she's friends with in her town, mm-hmm. who she gets together with. So I think I'm a big believer in both, and just as a general approach to life.
Right.
My guess is that it's going to be both and when it comes to that.
So I'd like to ask about the trust factor. I mean, I've done a lot of work around group dynamics and teams, as I know you have, and right. you know, almost all of the research points to the key variable of trust as being essential to a well-functioning group. And I don't think it's just teams and small groups. I think that's true for a congregation at large. I mean, if there isn't right. trust, you know, it just doesn't work very well. And I wondered whether you think that the critical task of building and maintaining trust is compromised or different in virtual spaces.
That's a really great question, and there's obviously no simple answer to that one. Now I agree with you about, so I always did that famous book, Five Dysfunctions of Teams.
Right, yes.
I say those are also the five dysfunctions, those are also the five dysfunctions of a congregation.
And, right.
And so trust is definitely the toughest thing to build under any circumstance. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with a congregation right now where the head of staff says, you know, I've been using your book, John, about teams with my staff, and everybody's in agreement, but the fact of the matter is we don't trust each other. And I just don't know how to build that trust with this particular group of people. So I do think that the virtual age is going to make the trust thing both more possible and more difficult. More difficult in that everybody's got access to information, some of which can be compromised as trust. But it also can be, if you are transparent as an organization, and every organization has to be transparent in the 21st century, you can build trust by, for example, I see no reason why governing board minutes or financial records or anything else should not be on a website and accessible at a minimum to all the members. And some of the congregations I work with make it accessible even to the public at large. So you can, by making more, you know, one of the ways to build trust is to make sure that everybody has the same information. But again, paying really close attention, use the word group dynamics, and that's what it is. Paying really close attention to group dynamics and because there's so much research, as you know, in this field about how you build trust in groups. But few of us are skilled in that. And
right.
few of us have even read significant amounts of literature about that. Absolutely crucial.
Yeah. So one of the things that occurred to me personally is we were making the transition in March 2020 from doing everything in person to then all of a sudden meeting and working and having worship in virtual spaces is I thought to myself, you know, I already know all these people. I know who the players are. I have a past relationship with them. I trust them. And I thought about how different it would be if I were trying to, you know, be in a virtual group with people I didn't know, or what it would be like to try to start a new group or bring new people into a group. What are some best practices, do you think, for that, for onboarding people or creating new groups and with that key variable of trust when you're working in a virtual space?
Yeah, I don't know if we know any best practices because it's so early. I mean, what the stories I heard were either really good were really bad. There was almost no, because there were, I worked with one church that brought three new staff people on board during the pandemic, and they met face-to-face for the first time about 2 or 3 months ago, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, it worked really well. There was another congregation where they brought in a key staff person, and it just totally blew up. And a lot of it was over the trust issue, trust stuff. So I don't know that we know best practices, But I would say, just going back to basic group dynamics stuff that you were talking about, that my guess is it's probably the same as bringing a person on board in a live setting, in a face-to-face setting. And what I mean by that is when you bring somebody on board, you have to spend a lot of time in the early part bringing them on board and then pulling back as they figure out what they're going to do, because they just have a lot more questions in the beginning. So I think that the key would be having more meetings than one would like with Zoom or equivalent kind of virtual technology to make sure that the person understands what they're supposed to do. I also would narrow the scope of the job. Mm-hmm. I would get real tight about, okay, this is what we really need you to do during this period. Your job is going to expand once we can meet face to face. But right now, what we need you to do is this, and just concentrate on this so that they can stay focused. Because one of the problems in work in general is staying focused. But I think during this entire pandemic period, and kind of now in the hybrid period, staying focused is even more challenged. And you've got all the anxiety about the pandemic itself, and the anxiety of, you know, being in a home with people 24/7. I mean, I've said, I'm just so grateful. I love my wife and she loves me, because I can't imagine going through this with somebody I didn't like,
right,
you know, or like me. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, one of the clear subtexts, it's not even a subtext, it's a clear message in your book that, you know, that as different as we may feel that things are during this pandemic period, or as we transition into more virtual encounters, really the same principles and rules apply. and good group dynamics are good group dynamics. Good staff management is good staff management. Good accountability is good accountability. And it just sort of points us to some of the fundamentals. I think that's been true in so many areas of church life as we've thought about the impact of the pandemic. I want to begin to wrap this up, and I thought I might end by asking you, I know nobody has a crystal ball, and it's hard for me to think 2 weeks ahead right now, but where do you think we're headed in terms of the balance between remote engagement and in-person engagement when it comes to the programmatic and administrative life of the church?
Right. So I think, as I said, I think meetings are going to be overwhelmingly virtual. I think that education is going to be the field that changes the most as a result of this. I mean, there's so many people. So there was a church I worked with that had the biggest adult education program I've seen. They had about 500 people in worship. They had about 120 adults on Sunday morning in adult education classes. So I called them several months into the pandemic. I said, "So how's that going?" And Lee said, "Well, it didn't go well at first." He says, "Because as you know, most of the folks in those classes are older." He says, "But they all managed the technology, you know, their grandkids or somebody showed them how to do this stuff," which has also been kind of amazing that all these old folks, and I'm an old folk, so I'm talking about ourselves, managed that transition actually fairly well. He said, "Now we actually have more people attending classes than we did then because of the ease of it. And we also have people who aren't members attending classes as well." And the same thing's going to go on with kids and youth, because for a long time I've been arguing, why do we think that kids Sunday school can only operate at 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday when most kids are out playing soccer? I mean, it's just crazy. And so because they couldn't do that, and the kids couldn't play soccer either, a lot of religious educators got very creative. And I think a lot of religious education going forward is going to look a lot like homeschooling that's been going on for the past year and a half with the pandemic. So religious educators, instead of setting up classrooms, are going to be setting up all kinds of video material you know, creating material or finding material that they can feed, which also means that the parents are going to have to get much more involved in this than they've been in the past. It's not going to be dropping the kids off at church and then coming back and picking them up an hour later. They're going to have to find an hour during the week that they spend with their kids working virtually with educational materials. So from a program perspective, that's what I think is going to get affected the most is going to be education.
That's probably a really good thing, ultimately, have parents hands-on in terms of their kids' religious education.
Just to break up this thing about 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, too. I mean, that model's been dead for 20 or 30 years.
Right. Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, John, and I really appreciate the clarity that you bring to so many of these issues. I know our listeners will too. So again, the book is Managing Congregations in the Virtual Age. And thanks to you, John, for producing such a helpful resource and for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for all you do at Wesley and Beyond.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Priscilla Pope Levinson about models of evangelism.
As I went back through each model and looked at what is a characteristic that is inclusive of all of the models, and I came up with five: the hospitality, integrity, relationship, message bearing, and church rootedness. I think that integrity piece is so important, because many people, including our 20-something kids, find Christians to be hypocritical because they say one thing and do another. And I think we could go a long way to clear up some of the misconception over the word evangelism, that it really is good news if we are people who, to use the phrase, walk the talk or talk the walk, that there is this sense of integrity between the gospel message that we present and who we are as gospel bearers. It sounds simplistic, but Doug, I really think that would go a long way to recapturing evangelism as something that is positive and winsome and hospitable.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.